Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. It's March 2018 as I speak. New World Notes is always a little out of sync with the world, so you won't be surprised to hear a talk by Martin Luther King just after Black History Month has ended, and 1 month before the 50th anniversary of King's death on April 4, 1968. We will hear one of King's lesser-known speeches, somewhat condensed. King spoke at Stanford University in California on April 14, 1967. That is just 10 days after King gave his great, powerful, and extremely ill-received speech, Beyond Vietnam, at Riverside Church in New York City. In both speeches, King goes beyond mere civil rights to stress the issues of economic inequality and also the tragedy of an out-of-control military-industrial congressional complex. The speech is titled The Other America. Here is Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I'd like to use as a subject from which to speak the other America. There are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful, and in a sense this America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, and culture and education for their minds. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental sky. This other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-Americans, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians. Millions of them are Appalachian white. Probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size in the population is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto, a ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto of human misery. So what we are seeking to do in the civil rights movement is to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The struggle for civil rights and the struggle to make these two Americas one America is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. We struggled all across the South to get rid of legal, overt segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodations. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. And the struggle was to deal with these problems. And by the thousands, we protested these conditions. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. In 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being. We were able to get a voting rights bill. Now, all of these things represented strides. But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good, solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality. And so today, we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. This is what makes the struggle much more difficult. Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today, the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than whites. And we see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate of the nation as a whole is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, and so they can be calculated. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope, and so they no longer go to look for a job. These persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 or 7% in the Negro community. And that means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. And among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. In the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now the other thing that we've got to come to see now that is that racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realize. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race, that one particular group is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insight, and the total flow of history. And the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved and innately inferior. Racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I am not good enough to live next door to him, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him, merely because of my race, He is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. That however unpleasant it is, we must honestly see and admit that racism is still deeply rooted all over America. What it is necessary to see is that there has never been a single solid monistic determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans. The whole question of civil rights and on the whole question of racial equality. It is said on the Statue of Liberty that America is a home of exiles. But it doesn't take us long to realize that America has been the home of its white exiles from Europe. But it has not evinced the same kind of maternal care and concern for its black exiles from Africa. In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery, but at the same time, the nation refused to give him land to make that freedom meaningful. And at that same period, America was giving millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that America was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor that would make it possible to grow and develop, and refused to give that economic floor to its black peasants, so to speak. That it was freedom without bread to eat, freedom without land to cultivate. But it does not stop there. In 1875, the nation passed a civil rights bill and refused to enforce it. In 1964, the nation passed a weaker civil rights bill, and even to this day, that bill has not been totally enforced in all of its dimensions. The nation heralded a new day of concern for the poor, for the poverty-stricken, for the disadvantaged, and brought into being a poverty bill. But at the same time, it put such little money into the program that it was hardly and still remains hardly a good skirmish against poverty. And all of these things tell us that America has been backlashing on the whole question of basic constitutional and God-given rights for Negroes and other disadvantaged groups for more than 300 years. Persistence of widespread slums and of tragic conditions in schools and other areas of life. All of these things have brought about a great deal of despair, great deal of disappointment and even bitterness in the Negro communities. And today all of our cities confront huge problems as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger engage in riots. Let me say, and I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom and justice. Violence will only create more social problems than they will solve. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. That riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. A riot is the language of the unheard. America has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years, failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met, and it has failed to hear that large segment of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And if we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America. Somewhere we must come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. I'm convinced that we still need strong civil rights legislation. And there's a bill before Congress right now to have a national federal open housing bill, federal law declaring discrimination in housing unconstitutional, and also a bill to make the administration of justice real all over our country. And so there is a need for a federal law dealing with the whole question of the administration of justice. There is a need for fair housing laws all over our country. And it is tragic indeed that Congress last year allowed this bill to die. And I can see no more dangerous trend in our country than the constant developing of predominantly Negro-central cities ringed by white suburbs. This is only inviting social disaster. And the only way this problem will be solved is by the nation taking a strong stand and by state governments taking a strong stand against housing segregation and against discrimination in all of these areas. Now, there's another thing that I'd like to mention as I talk about the massive action program, and time will not permit me to go into specific programmatic action to any great degree. But it must be realized now that the Negro cannot solve the problem by himself. Now, there again, there are those who always say to Negroes, why don't you do something for yourself? Why don't you lift yourselves by your own bootstraps? Certainly, there are many things that we must do for ourselves and that only we can do for ourselves. Certainly, we must develop within a sense of dignity and self-respect that nobody else can give us, a sense of not being ashamed of our heritage, not being ashamed of our color. It was wrong and tragic that the Negro ever allowed himself to be ashamed of the fact that he was black, or ashamed of the fact that his ancestral home was Africa. And so there's a great deal that the Negro can do to develop self-respect. There's a great deal that the Negro must do and can do to amass political and economic power within his own community and by using his own resources. And so we must do certain things for ourselves, but this must not negate the fact that the Negro cannot solve the problem himself. A man was on the plane with me some weeks ago, and he came and talked with me, and he said, the problem, Dr. King, that I see with what you all are doing is that every time I see you and other Negroes, you are protesting, and you aren't doing anything for yourself. He went on to tell me that he was very poor at one time, and he was able to make it by doing something for himself. Why don't you teach your people, he said, to lift themselves by their own bootstraps? And then he went on to say other groups face disadvantages, the Irish, the Italians, and he went down the line. And I said to him that it does not help the Negro, it only deepens his frustration for unfeeling and sensitive people to say to him that other ethnic groups who migrated or were immigrants to this country just 100 years ago or so have gotten beyond him, and he came here some 344 years ago. And I went on to remind him that the Negro came to this country involuntarily in chains, while others came voluntarily. I went on to remind him that no other racial group has been a slave on American soil. I went on to remind him that the other problem that we have faced over the years is that the society placed a stigma on the color of the Negro, on the color of his skin, because he was black. Doors were closed to him that were not closed to other groups. And I finally said to him that it's a nice thing to say to people that you ought to lift yourself by your own bootstraps, But it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And the fact is that millions of Negroes, as a result of centuries of denial and neglect, have been left bootless, and they find themselves impoverished aliens in this affluent society. And that is a great deal that the society can and must do if the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs. Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country. It seems to me that the civil rights movement must now begin to organize for the guaranteed annual income, begin to organize people all over our country and mobilize forces so that we can bring to the attention of our nation this need and this something which I believe will go a long, long way toward dealing with the Negro's economic problem and the economic problem with many other poor people confronting our nation. Now, I said I wasn't going to talk about Vietnam, but I can't make a speech without mentioning some of the problems that we face there. Because I think this war has diverted attention from civil rights, it has strengthened the forces of reaction in our country and has brought to the forefront the military-industrial complex that even President Eisenhower warned us against at one time. And above all, it is destroying human lives, destroying the lives of thousands of the young, promising men of our nation. Destroying the lives of little boys and little girls in Vietnam. But one of the greatest things that this war is doing to us in civil rights is that it is allowing the great society to be shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam every day. We can end poverty in the United States. Our nation has the resources to do it. We have the resources. The question is whether our nation has the will, and I submit that if we can spend $35 billion a year to fight an ill-considered war in Vietnam and $20 billion to put a man on the moon, our nation can spend billions of dollars to put God's children on their own 2 feet right here on earth. It is necessary for us to realize more than ever before that the destinies of the Negro and the white man are tied together. The Negro needs the white man to save him from his fear. The white man needs the Negro to save him from his guilt. We are tied together in so many ways: our language, our music, our cultural patterns, our material prosperity, and even our food, an amalgam of black and white. And so there can be no separate black path to power and fulfillment that does not intersect white roots. And there can be no separate white path to power and fulfillment short of social disaster. It does not recognize the need of sharing that power with black aspirations for freedom and justice. Integration must be seen also in political terms, where there is shared power and where black men and white men share power together to build a new and a great nation. In a real sense, we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And so we are all in the same situation. The salvation of the Negro will mean the salvation of the white man and the destruction of the life and of the ongoing progress of the Negro will be the destruction of the ongoing progress of the nation. We have difficult days ahead, but I haven't despaired, but I still have faith in the future. And I still believe that these problems can be solved. And so I will not join anyone who will say that we still can't develop a coalition of conscience, but I am still convinced that there are still many white persons of goodwill, and I'm happy to say that I see them every day in the student generation, who cherish democratic principles and justice above principle, and who will stick with the cause of justice and the cause of civil rights and the cause of peace throughout the days ahead. And so I refuse to despair. I think we are going to achieve our freedom, because however much America strays away from the ideals of justice, the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up in the destiny of America. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and oppressive conditions. And yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to grow and develop. And I say that if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom, because both the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of the Almighty God are embodied in our echoing demands. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth's crest to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and live together as brothers and sisters all over this great nation. That will be a great day, that will be a great tomorrow. In the words of the scripture, to speak symbolically, that will be the day when the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy. Thank you.
Martin Luther King's little-known but very good speech, The Other America, delivered April 14, 1967. Thanks to the old radio program, DC-37 Radio, for the skillfully condensed audio. And thank you for listening to our radio show, New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.